One of the things I think I was hearing throughout some of the various talks, certainly with the stuff with the Higgs boson, also I think in Jill's talk earlier today, is that there are often, in these contexts that are generating large amounts of data. I should add, using big data was a bit of a provocation for you guys, so I'm glad that many of you rose to it. Some of you came down one side, and some of you came down the other side. But it was intentionally provocative to stick big data in the title, since I myself also had mixed feelings about the whole thing. But since there's so many steps often to the processes that are behind, for example, generating all the evidence for the Higgs boson, generating the massive amounts of data sets that they want to integrate in computational biology. And since we often can say that maybe on certain small pieces of problems, we know how to do what we think is solve a problem well, what are your thoughts on trying to, if we look to the scaling up of the title of this this colloquium, what are your thoughts on trying to be able to address the whole? And I might throw out there, for example, the so-called uncertainty quantification field that is also arising in certain areas as an attempt to try and quantify uncertainty that's inherent in many of the multiple steps of the overall. It's very open-ended as a question, but I think it's one that is touched upon in a number of ways in today's talks and sort of maybe goes to the heart of some of the tension of trying to stay true to some of the philosophical foundations that we'd like to adhere to, but also having a limitation to what we've been able to build so far. So.
You're the philosopher. That's the star.
Well, I don't know. Excuse me. So you said it's an open-ended question. I'll give an answer that is maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of the question. So I think one of the reasons why it's interesting and beneficial for philosophers to look at statistics is because I think statistics has developed methodologies and frameworks for dealing with a kind of problem that I think philosophers have not conceptualized terribly well, which is the question of what's the sort of space of possibilities of error of what are the different ways we could go wrong, and you can ask that question at different sort of levels, and I know this is something that that Deborah has given quite a lot of thought to, and her colleague Araspanos, as she mentioned, this idea of testing model assumptions, and I think the concern in the talk just now about not having it just be a kind of art where we say, well, you know, it's good enough. It seems to give us what we want. I think if you look in philosophy of science at a lot of the discussion is about sort of theory choice and posing the question at a sort of very high level that's very abstracted away from the data, and I think that that just exacerbates this problem that you can't characterize. It becomes very difficult to characterize the sort of space of possible errors. So I'm sort of hopeful, and I really don't know if I'm really addressing your question, but I'm hopeful that as philosophers pay more attention to statistical practice and the way that in really grappling with data, those kinds of questions about what the space of possible errors are, that there could be some hope of getting a better handle on when we turn to sort of substantive level inferences, can we characterize what that space of possible errors looks like in a more systematic or more principled way?
Yeah, I actually thought it was very good. So
at least one of the things which I kind of like to stick to is, and that gets very much back to your point about we need to understand what all the possible errors are, is if you want to go to the moon, are you going to define an ill-posed problem you have to solve? A wrong problem, which is not representing the reality? Or are you really going to pose the very problem we have to solve?
It depends on which moon I will be going to, but...
And so that's what we should start doing more in statistics. What is the true estimation problem we have to solve? What do we truly know? And what do we truly want to learn? And that's kind of, at least that's my philosophical approach, which I don't think contradicts, but it, as I called it, is the kind of an erosion which has happened, where people feel it's all an art, you know, we don't need a truth, everybody's right or everybody's wrong. No. Let's define the truth, and let that define the real estimation problem we need to address. And then it becomes also possible to start talking about what are your theorems? What are your real formal claims? And where are the assumptions? And then where can it go wrong? Because maybe these assumptions are not right. Maybe we need simulations to still see how good it is, right? Or, and so on and so on. So I think that's, for me at least, how I often like to think.
So that's really a philosophical question itself. It's a huge question. But I think, and I've used the philosophical term, I don't think that question can be truly answered. But my take here is use a cliche phrase that is really you think globally and act locally, right? So what I mean by that, you know, this actually I mentioned briefly about the work I'm doing on this multi-facing, for instance. Like if you start thinking about the possible errors, you really have to worry about how the data were collected, how the data was pre-processed, because every step someone has made some decision, right? That any time the data being cleaned in some way, or make it even more dirty, but whatever it is, the people who are doing it must have made some judgment. Otherwise, they won't do it. They thought by doing that is helpful. Okay, at least you hope this can help. But the thing is that once you start trying to put down one big model, this is the problem with the Bayesian analysis. So if you think in a dogmatic way, you will completely run into this dead end, because it's just simply impossible to put down one mathematical model is coherent to describe all these processes, right? Because even you assume everybody has done their best work, then they use the best judgment, they use the best information. They're still incompatible with each other. Very simple example is anytime you deal with medical data, there's confidentiality, right? Somebody trying to clean some data or protect confidentiality, they cannot even tell you how the data was protected. Right? So there's no way they could be coherent. And so if you're really trying to do this, trying to take into account all these errors quantitatively, I don't think that's possible. But at the same time, just being aware of things could have gone wrong, just think qualitatively that you should have aware of all these possible errors. I think that's actually extremely useful. This reminds me, a couple years ago, I was attending a conference, that was an ENR conference. They were talking about reproducibility, right? You make the research reproducible. What document you need to keep, right? The extreme form of documentation is every time you hire any postdoc or any students, every step they work on, even things they thought about, they want to work on, but they didn't, because that's a form of selection, right? It could be all relevant. So there was and of course then somebody realized, no, if you can propose, that's a criteria, forget it. You just completely derail the effort, because no scientist will want to subject himself into that. So if you think of this whole approach, but trying to quantify everything, document everything, that's impossible, but qualitatively to be aware of that anything could go wrong. I mean, that's actually incredibly important. So from that perspective, I really appreciate what you said about the sort of high physicists, they're trying to take us a high standard, right? Make the bar very high. I think in some sense that we may think the bar is actually still too low, because we don't know what that 5 sigma really means. But nevertheless, the notion trying to make the high standard is always like you may have heard some of us have been suggesting that anytime you get the sigma, whatever the estimate of sigma, multiply by two. Okay,
whatever you're doing, just multiply by two. There's actually some theory behind why that is a good multiplier. The idea is to cover all the other errors that I have not thought about, right? But I know it's there, right? And so I think that's very useful. But actually, I do have a question for you. I was wondering, how did the physicists have built such a culture? They have this high bar for themselves. You mentioned because there is a huge cost, huge investment, but so was it in many other fields. You know, biology, medicals, the cost is huge, right? But developing a drug is huge, and there is we don't see anything nearly 5 sigma.
Right.
So how? What was the saying in the physics community that leads to that?
I don't think there's a really nice, neat, short way answer to that question. There has been some interesting historical work done on that recently, not by me, but by Alan Franklin. The Five Sigma standard is really something that that evolved over time and became more or less institutionalized. And I have to emphasize, it's not a completely rigid standard,
sure.
But more or less institutionalized around the time of the discovery of the top quark in the mid 90s, and the sort of forces that pushed it were the fact that, you know, particle physicists, they produce a lot of data. Of course, lots of people produce lots of data, but they keep track of the things that turn out wrong, and they can point to the historical examples. Here was a 3 sigma result that turned out to be wrong. There's a 4 sigma result that turned out to be wrong. And so it's sort of a response to, in part, it's a response to this history and you know, have they done the calculation to say, well, we got more false four sigma results than we should have given the number of results that we published? No, not really. But that's kind of the history.
So it's like a super learner. You know, they keep do cross validation.
Now, what I also hear is, I mean, there's there is now a movement by Medican at I think in New York.
David
Medican. Right. I mean, he's also doing that now in medicine, where he uses. I mean, again, I think there, he uses. I mean, people have been raising this issue that people are finding all these false positives, right? And so that therefore the statistical theory is not working. The p-values or whatever are not working. So anyway, and then his response is, okay, one thing we can do is to, in these medical databases, we have a lot of negative controls, right? We know that certain treatments should have no effect, right, on certain outcomes. And so let's create a database of these and apply the same procedures, right, and see what it gives. And then we know the truth should be null, and then all these and then it gives a new null distribution and get a p-value from that. So that sounds, what you describe sounds a little bit like that, except it doesn't sound too formal in the sense that they actually collected the whole, but it's in that direction.
But that's actually a really interesting point, because essentially we're saying our theory, even the best theory we have, really have not characterized the reality, right? So we do all these empirical adjustment. This also reminds me, years ago I was teaching at the University of Chicago, I was teaching sample survey. So I'm using, you know, the Gallup pool, right? So, you know, I teach them all the confidence intervals. So when I get the Gallup pool results, and their confidence interval is always a little bit wider than what the theory was saying. So I was very curious, like, where did they get this? Eventually I get a hold of Gallup, they have an internal correction table, right? They have an internal correction table, so if you are in this region, if you want to do the 95%, multiply the interval by 1.2. In some other region, you buy 1.3. So what they did is exactly what they, like what you mentioned, they look at it historically, all the things they've done, then they just do this correction. This correction table itself has no theory, but it works. Like your point, because, you know, that gets calibrated, right?
Finish your thought.
No, but my thought is that as we do more, then hopefully the theory will catch up to explain what these collaborations are. Then, of course, once they catch up, then new problem comes in. So you always do catch up.
I like this fact of using negative controls, right? Because they, but I don't think it should be used as an escape for doing good science. And that's, I think, that's why my take. I've seen so many articles by Gary Touts and others about all about, you know, in epidemiology we have these biased results and everything is wrong, and but nobody making the point that they use methods which are known to be biased, right? It's all about the design and that's observational, but even when it's an observational data study, if you use a logistic regression, a parametric model, which we all know is wrong, even when there's no effect, there is going to be pure by confounding, you are going to find an effect, certainly if the sample size is large enough. And so that point has to be hit home much more, and that's, at least in my research, I really focus on starting to work on developing methods which are able to remove these biases as much as possible. And even then, there's no guarantees, because if you do the most, there's always some conditions in a theorem, so I still like the negative control.
I think one has to keep in mind that the case of physics with laws very different from cases in medicine and certainly psychology and other social sciences where you have vastly variable phenomena. So for starters, I don't think you should consider the same kinds of methods. But I think the most pressing problem is one of the ones alluded to, that we see all these articles saying that there's lack of replication and these models are really wrong, and there's this tendency for epidemiologists especially to think, well, if you haven't generated the data and it's not randomized, then since you really can't vouchsafe for the model, we really need to recognize that this is just our subjective beliefs. In other words, we get this radically different methodology based on one case with a model you could still test and check. There shouldn't be some sort of vastly different methodology. And so we have some bizarre things being said, even in, I think, in some of the top textbooks and sort of weekly, last week was Nature and the week before Science, about these articles that kind of, I think, misrepresent the problem.
I think it's an excellent point that made me remind now of because a typical thing in this whole field who just say, in an observational study, to claim your result is true, you have to reproduce it 3 or 4 times in a row. But what they don't seem to get, if you use 4 times a biased method, it's going to be 4 times biased.
You actually confirm the bias because,
exactly.
Because you think it's validated.
So there is nothing. You first need a good method. Then you can start saying, try to reproduce it. So it's a good point. Yeah.
So the first thing you said when you started this conversation was, some people came down on one side of big data and the other, some people came down on the other side. What are the two sides? I'm serious. I'm completely 100% serious.
Just
say the word. Okay.
Just that people seem to be coming down on different sides skepticism of the whole use of the term, or whether it was leading to something new or not, or whether it was leading us to whether the old thing, the more classical traditional issues were relevant or not relevant, and I just threw that into the title partially because the term bugs me in and of itself. I think Marx said in one of his comments that often big data is used by various groups to sort of put a label on something that then postulates that what they have to bring to the table is quite important, because it usually is, but what hardly is often discussed often is statistics, which because it's data you would think. So I threw that out there because to sort of force this tension in some sense. Rather than looking, as I said at the beginning of the meeting, rather than saying when Lisa approached me about having something joint for the day and saying, well, philosophy, statistics, foundation, so we can all talk about Neyman and Pearson and just stick back to the history, which is the other part of your center. Instead, throw something in there that would sort of nudge us to look forward because I think all the fields and everything we've heard here is looking forward while still not predicting the outcomes. So that's more like, I didn't think that was too science specific, but mainly just sort of what people's reactions to your project may be.
So is your concern that when people say we have, you know, we are using big data and have a tremendous amount of data that gives their assertions more weight in the presence of faulty statistics? Is that your concern?
If we're asking what my concerns are personally, one of my concerns is that in the rush to focus on big data as an error, there is some of it is a rush to feel that if we have enough data, whatever that is, then we don't need statistics. And also that with the challenges that are brought by the big data, that somehow the statistical issues underlying doing data analysis of any type are really secondary. If we can handle the data, manipulate the data, if we collect the right data, then the statistics is not really so much an issue anymore. Somehow, whether that's implicit or explicit, that seems to suggest press. Let me use your question actually to bounce a second sort of large scale question at people, going to one of the issues that Deborah brought up, talking about experimental design. Jill talked about that a little bit. We had experimental design in physics as well. Many of the contexts that develop big data certainly have experimental protocols of some sort behind them, but also many of them seem to basically set up a detector or a sensor or disk space, basically, and register every click that we generate, or every, you know, Shali was talking about, and individualize everything. And part of what seems to be inherent in that particular event, particularly as been picked up by the business communities, it seems to be, is that you just measure everything, and then you do it. So let me just throw out there, again, as an open-ended sort of thing, where is experimental design in all of this? Where should it be? Where could it help?
Well, of course, I spoke about that. So, you know, obviously, I think that it's very important to talk about how you generate and model the data. I think there's a certain related point that maybe hasn't been discussed enough, that the big data, this whole idea that we're interested in getting it right in some proportion, that we're interested in false discovery rates, and that all of science becomes a kind of screening exercise is really very misleading, along the same lines that we only care about correlations, and so it really doesn't matter how data were generated. That what we get is this kind of mentality of how often will you write over the year? Is that really how science takes place? I think that's absolutely not. And if you look at the most successful Nobel Prize-winning science, there are maybe they're wrong 90% of the time until they finally find one substance that works. So I think the general mentality of screening that comes out of the big data, that comes out of the idea that we really don't need to worry too much about experimental design because we have so much of it, is all of a piece, and that is moving us away from being able to say what we have found out about this theory or this phenomena, or for that matter, this person.
I think the case of particle physics is a little bit singular compared to a lot of other experimental sciences because it's based around these enormous and very expensive detectors at these very select locations, particle accelerators. And those, because of the huge investment in these devices, the detectors themselves have to essentially serve as long-term platforms for a variety of experimental undertakings that can be all be pursued with a single device. So It's not a case of, well, we're going to measure everything, because the detector itself is designed to measure very particular things of physical interest. On the other hand, the things that are of interest have to be of interest not just for the search for the Higgs. It's got to be that and the search for leptoquarks or you know whatever else that they're looking for. So the design design is both the design of the instrument for these sort of general experimental goals, but then once you have the data, it's the extraction of the data and the analysis of it is then where you get the tailoring to specific. So it may not even really fall neatly into. I have to confess, I had to Google the phrase big data when I got the invitation. It's like, okay, what does that mean? it may not be a very good example of big data in the sense that that term is sometimes used, because in a certain sense it is a lot of data. But it is still data collected in more or less the way that particle physicists have been collecting data all along.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about, what kind of response we have on big data. And I agree with the response that what I see, that it becomes a political thing. It has been used to put the power in the hands of non-statisticians. And they... Indeed, including computer scientists, but even
I don't know anything about this.
I know, but even subject matter people. I mean, where you see whatever some kind of astrologist getting,
Hey, astrology needs lots of data.
I know. So the people who have data somehow start having the power and start making the decision about what data science is. But let's not forget, statistics is the science of learning from data. It is data science. So what is happening is that to an even larger degree than what I have seen, which was bad enough, which was computational biology, when that came up, right? That this just became this field where everybody was a statistician. At Berkeley, everybody had to fill in a question, every faculty member. All of them said, I'm a statistician.
Yes.
Okay? So there was this idea like, we don't need statistics anymore. I can all do it we can all do it by ourselves. So in a way, it's... But now it is significantly worse. So in that sense, I think, and there are movements, there are people now who say, since we measure everything, all we need are correlations. I mean, it's so stupid, I don't even know where to start. Or we don't have to think about randomness anymore because we have everything. Right? And the idea that there's a sample size big enough to deal with the curse of dimensionality, you have to just do a calculation. Right? If you have 20 covariates with 5 categories, it's 5 to the power 20. We're already far beyond the numbers they're talking about. So that means we will have empty strata all over. So there is a curse of dimensionality, believe me. So all of it makes no sense, but it is all used politically to start drawing the money away from statistics. And that's what I see at my own university.
Clearly he's not getting enough funding, so...
Exactly. But anyway, the other thing is the design of experiments is, of course, hugely important and should be. In other words, how can you start collecting data if you don't even know yet how to properly analyze it, right? So design should always be informed by what are you going to do with it. So you first need to be very well trained in how you're going to analyze, to deal with all the issues. Missingness is going to still be there. Confounding, all these issues. What do you want to learn? All that is there, and your design should be, keep that in mind. And it's not happening.
Well, I certainly completely agree with that. And I think it'd be useful to think a little bit about how the design experiment was developed. Then, lots of design experiment developed, it was because of cost issue. Think about all the industrial design, all this factorial design. You push the boundary, you do these, you try to get the fewest run as possible to get as much of the answer as possible, right? Just because the experiment was costly or some was destructive. But what happened during that process that we thought really hard about what is a good way of collecting data, right? The consequence of that is, as we all know, that the better design you have, the easier analysis later becomes, right? So what happened now is that we actually, I think a part of the big data phenomena is really we're doing ourselves a disservice, right? Because we find the things are cheap, we don't have to think. We'll just collect everything. I don't have to think about it. If I'm taking that as a job, my boss wants me to collect data, what would it be if the machine is running the whole night, who cares about electricity costs, everything? Let's collect the data. But what happened is we should keep in mind every time you have a data point, not only comes in with information, it also comes with noise, like what I was talking about today. Everything in some sense is noise. It's all you, how you define it. So only these methods that, you know, the method we're trying to develop is really trying to tease out what's the information, what's the noise, right? And now recently I've been writing papers about, you know, there are even very common statistical methods, like least square. Right? You can have more data running least square, you get actually less accurate than estimator. Right? So you know, people think of more data gives you more information, therefore you get a better answer. Well, that's only if you know how to use this information. Because otherwise, more data, you know, you can debate philosophically, why not more data means more noise? Right? Actually, the more data do give you more, you know, more noise. The simple least square estimate can give you a terrible answer if you keep adding data, but if the data had really different variability, you're keeping adding those with large availability, it's completely wipe out the efficiency you had with a smaller data set, right? So I think lots of problems we have created with big data is really we create a big noise, right? But we don't realize that. And then lots of hard things people say, as Deborah was saying at the very beginning, you know, lots of those things is really because that when these big data, when all these big data come in, because we have not really think carefully, we actually create lots of problems for ourselves. Later we try to clean them, right? I mean, it's
a postmortem. Right?
It's a postmortem, and you know, it's good for creating job, but not necessarily doing the good science. Right? So I think that actually, if you think of the foundation of the, you know, like Fisher, right? Fisher did a lot of inference. But Fisher was also one of the founders of the, you know, experiment design. And these thinkings are truly should be there. I mean, I think so. Thinking much harder about doing how you collect the data is so important, not just for the analysis part, not for getting the right answer, but really developing all these methodology. But there are fields like, you know, high energy physics, I think that they do need to collect a lot of data because their signal is so rare. I mean, you really need that huge denominator to get that tiny thing. But like lots of other things, if they put a little bit of effort there, you don't need to collect that much data at all. Most of them are wasted. Now we think about subsampling, right? Now we think about, you know, too much data. Let's do a subsampling. I mean, the good analogy is like, it's like, you know, someone's garage is full of all the junks because he or she keep doing these like yard sale or yard, you know, get those things, oh, it's cheap, but someday I'm going to use it. You end up with full garage, and then you try to clean them. Right, so it's really, I think that we really need to push much harder about thinking this experiment design, but these are not easy.
You have a question here?
Yeah, well, this is all extremely stimulating, and I wanted just to you know, agree with Kent that high energy physics data is not big data, it's really data that happens to be big. And I mean, big data means something. And the comment about taking money away from statisticians and putting it in the hands of the domain experts, I chuckle at that because I think that the perception of big data is to make domain experts obsolete, not to put more power in their hands. And I think of...
That's an interesting thought.
And I think of... No, and I really mean it. I think of things like... the online dating sites. You don't need an expert matchmaker anymore. There used to be professional people who did that. Mm-hmm. Now you upload all the data that you can think of. Some machine learning algorithm turns in the background, matches people up. It works beautifully. You don't need experts in that anymore. Now there were several papers over the last two or three years on robotic scientists. I don't know if any of you have seen them. But the idea is that you can, as long as you provide enough data, you can feed the data in, it can be analyzed, and laws of motion can be inferred from that data. Poof, don't need scientists anymore. And so I think that instead of talking about revisiting the foundations of statistics, I wonder if we aren't talking about revisiting the foundations of science altogether and the way one gathers knowledge from the environment. Is science passe?
Go ahead.
Well, precisely what I said before, I think it's a completely wrong-headed view of science, and maybe some of the chickens are coming home to roost because they realize with all these correlations, they really aren't getting knowledge. I mean, I do agree that there are areas where the correlational knowledge may be all you want, but we won't get to understand causes and we won't get to understand generalizations or explanations that way, and thinking in terms of false discovery rates, all I care about is being wrong not too often in the next 20 years or something, pushing together all different fields. I mean, this is the worst kind of behaviorism, I think. So I think that if science could have been reduced to the robots, maybe they would have, but I think it is very important for people to think about knowledge and the obstacles that we actually create by imagining that it's just all correlational, machine-generated. I have seen so many algorithms, causal modeling and all kinds of fancy things because I hang out with economists and they've got the best, you know, they've got the biggest.
Sure.
But if you look at these so-called tests of them, they're always based on some kind of simulations where somebody knows the answer. They don't have any evidence of reliability whatsoever on these, at least not unless they are sufficiently adaptive and use kinds of background information. But by and large, it's just made-up toy simulations, I think. But you would know. You deal with bioinformatics. You know how the simulations go.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that particular point, of course, I agree with you entirely on the whole notion of the importance of science and using science in the traditional way to establish causality and to understand causation. I mean, you know, you're talking about going to the moon. Well, you wouldn't go to the moon just based on the observations you were able to make and process by machine learning on Earth. I mean, you really need a theory.
Yes, sir. Yeah, so that's why I also think that there's so much scientific, there's the design of experiments where goes a lot of scientific thinking in, and also what is your question of interest, right? So that's where, I mean, I don't see computers taking that over yet. I'm not saying that in the very far future, many generations beyond us, things like that could be happening, right? But we are very far from that. But indeed, we are now at a very strange point where people stop thinking.
Yeah.
They collect data with no thinking. And they think correlations are giving the answer to all kinds of interesting questions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nonsense.
Well, and you brought up the point that big data may be more political than anything else.
Yeah.
That's really what worries me.
Yeah.
Is that people who control money, and I don't mean the NIH, really will see big data and correlation as the only thing that's really necessary.
Exactly.
I think you really raised a truly philosophical question, right? First is whether it's ever possible, basically when you say replaced by computer, you're basically saying whether the world can be replaced by a set of rules, right? No matter how complicated the set of rules, but there's a prescribed rules to explain everything. That's what could potentially reduce, you know, into a sort of computer form. But I personally don't believe that, although if I take a cynical view, what that's possible because we stop thinking, you know, all the scientists stop thinking, and eventually the machine become smarter than we are.
Exactly.
Right, so that's a cynical view. But the ones that always drive me nuts, that every time I hear on the radio anywhere saying, you know, this was predicted by a computer model, it's always driving me nuts. There's no such thing as a computer model, right? And even with all the artificial intelligence, it's always a model is described by human, right? So the question is really whether the world phenomena eventually can be, you know, described by a finite number of possibilities, and I just don't think that's possible. And I certainly don't think there will be ever a robotic, you know, philosopher. I hope there won't be something.
I know some. Oh no.
I feel like I need to submit a note of optimism here. And I'm going to do it by shifting a little bit from science to commerce for a second. And by the way, I come from the world of technology and commerce, where the term big data is kind of understood as a hype. It's a marketing term as much as anything else, so we're sort of careful about it. Although it doesn't mean real things, both in terms of volume and complexity. But if you take a look at the techniques that you talked about, and you take a look for, I'll give you two examples, maybe three. Law, predictive coding, is based on those techniques. Predictive coding reduces the cost of large litigation discovery from 50 million to 50,000. That's the scale of things, okay? If you're a law firm, large law firm, facing large litigation, that's what you're doing for your out of business. Okay? So yes, they know what they need to get to, they know what they need, but they use those techniques. In healthcare, it's exactly these techniques that have shown us, for example, don't ask me for somebody, decided that one additional encounter with a patient can translate to tens of thousands of dollars in revenues for providers and in cost. Okay. So it is taking on like wildfire, like wildfire. The thing with healthcare is that, you know, we're all moving toward population health. You cannot do population health. You cannot align cohorts and care pathways without using those techniques. It's going to be impossible. So, you know, we have to get to meaningful use two, maybe get into three before that stuff kicks in. We're not there. We're not even collecting data, right? I mean, that's a huge problem. We're not collecting it, not at the local sense and not at the sense of bringing data in from different institutions together to do it right. But it's moving in that direction. So my comment here is, maybe it's not science for the next few years. Maybe it's commerce that's going to push all this forward. And my sense is that's true, because it has to be if we're not going to run ourselves bankrupt. So my point is, you know, whether you're talking about SAP, Oracle, or, you know, Cold Light, smaller companies, they're all heavily invested in doing exactly what you're talking about. And by the way, this session has been great for me. I've learned a lot. But doing exactly that, because that's invariably, inevitably, what has to be done next.
Let me try to answer that. I completely understand your point. But let me first make sure we understand that, you know, in this kind of conference, that what we talk about is we trying to push the boundary. Right, we're trying to find out what are possibly those things are not doing right, and we find that lots of things not doing right. This does not discredit any of these developments. There are lots of things that are being done, and obviously it has been very successful. Otherwise, it won't be this buzzword, big data. Obviously, it creates lots of advance. But having said that, just from a scientific perspective or from a statistician's perspective, we also have to think about how many of anytime we think about these successful stories, we have to think about how many failed. Okay. The failed ones, you don't hear, right? I mean, everybody think about, you know, like Harvard has all these dropouts, you know, they're successful, right? The Facebook, you know, Bill Gates. But you have to know how many dropouts were not successful, you never heard from them, right? So from the scientific perspective, from the methodological perspective, we want to actually really to think about, first, how many of these successes, there will be success anyway, whether it's really low-hanging fruit. I mean, there are lots of results. You don't need accurate statistics, right? You look at the signal, it's so strong. You know that, you know, you do a little bit, it's there. You don't, any of these methods probably just to confirm it. It's not going to create new discovery, right? The second is, as we move forward, there will be fewer and fewer low-hanging fruit, right? And then the question is, like, how do we reduce these misuse, the bad use, which wasted so much, so that the good ones will be, you know, discovered earlier, will have more impact, right? Because, you know, obviously you can, if we do study, you can assign lots of examples where these really bad analysis have led to all sorts of waste. But you probably don't hear those things because, you know, very few people want to publicize those things.
Yeah, I mean, I see I see a lot of positivism. I mean, I don't want to be the cynical guy here, all right? Because I'm.
You are, but it's okay.
Okay, that's fine. The point is, when I work with students, I mean, that's energizing. There's a lot of positive spirit, right? But having said that, what concerns me in a much bigger scale is that the whole scientific field, we call it science, but is it still science? It is so political. People don't feel they have to say, okay, wait a minute, let me look at the actual literature. Let me see what has been done and see how I can distinctly either use that or build on it. It is all about islands of people reinventing the wheel and no accountability. And that is more and more happening, certainly with the big data now on top of that. And that is something, yeah, makes me feel, yeah, I just run to my students. I don't want to, it's not the world I want to be in. We are supposed to be scientists. We should care about moving things forward. And that's not happening in a large scale. And that doesn't mean there are all kinds of exceptions. I understand that. But on the bigger scale, it's not a pretty sight, at least. But it might change in a few years, who knows. But that's my take so far.
Well, I would be a little bit more optimistic than you are. I think I do think, you know, those things. Think about early years when a statistic being used. You know, these days, you know, most people would say, oh, let's do this Cox regression, do this, do that. Most people don't understand what Cox regression. Cox regression is not that easy to understand. But people use it, and it's in the software, they probably have done lots of good things, right? So what I'm thinking about is, if you think about early years when those things were developed, at that point, there must be smaller scale discussion as we have, because people rushing to use this methodology, and probably people develop it gets you know, very worried. But I think it hasn't made enough progress. But I do want to mention the one thing that actually really worries me is actually really has nothing to do with the big data. It's not even anything new. But it's just like there's so many of these methodologies have been used so often that we professionals, we know they're wrong. But because they've been used so often, it becomes such a standard that to a point that because other people are using it, it become a scientific justification of using it. And my most recent example, I was just in Chicago attending the AAAS conference, the Association of Advanced of Science. They just commissioned a study, which you guys are going to hear it, which is going to be, it's going to be probably quoted everywhere. It's about the science and the religion, right? How scientists converse with religion, you know, religion connect with science. So the preliminary data they have reported, they had 16,000 people they surveyed. And it was, you know, I give them the benefit of doubt. I think it was properly designed, you know, a scientific survey, and in which has about 500, you know, scientists, which is, you know, by some definition what the scientists mean, which is already questionable. But that's fine. You think that's, you know, find 500 scientists, that probably is not easy. But here was the thing that was really made me worry. So the data was used to illustrate all these points was, so the person was saying, okay, we have 16,000 data points, and there were about 11,000 responded. So first you already worry about the non-response bias. But then say the results we presented is based on these 9,000 cases where every question was answered. So you know, to us, immediate drive was nuts because you're doing the so-called complete case analysis, right? So, you know, so she went out to talk about things as if this is, and everybody was nodding because this is such a big sample, national data. So in the end, I want to raise the question, but I want to raise in a way not being offensive. So I said, since you only, I say in the literature it is well known that those who choose not respond, or those choose to respond partially, and those choose to respond fully are quite different and tend to be an association. Those who have a more strong opinion tend to respond more. So I said, should we interpret your results as representing those who have a strongest opinion? Which is not necessarily the wrong thing to look at, because science, religion, you know. So, I mean, she's actually pretty well-known sociologist. I would
I would expect she would respond, say, yeah, sure, you know, that's that you're giving me a nice way to interpret this. Her response was, no. I don't, she said, no. She said, you know, I understand your point, there's non-response bias, so on and so forth, but in social science, she literally said this, that it's a common standard that you only choose the data where you have complete answer. And also because my, you know, sample size, you know, response rate is 60% out there, that's good enough, so that's not an issue. She just completely dismissed our question, right? And I, at that point, I was a little bit speechless, because I was going to say, just because everybody does it, it doesn't make it right, but of course, that, then I dismissed the whole social science. So I end up not saying anything, although I feel pretty guilty about it. But that was the same type of thing that worries me, right? And then the rest of the audience didn't know. This was actually about a whole, about, you know, advanced science, communicating science. But the notion that this is not a problem at all, just because everybody is doing it, therefore it must be right. I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah. They stop thinking. Yeah.
That's exactly right. That's what I start thinking.
Did you have a question? Because you were...
Oh, I was going to ask, like, because you guys talked about how, like, design better in order to make the analysis easier, right? And so, like, I've worked some with economists and stuff, and the feeling that I've gotten from there is that, you know, like, if we design it correctly, then sort of, like, whatever method we use, you're going to get qualitatively the same sort of answer, essentially. Like, because, like, I guess, like, the feeling is, you know, there's going to be a lot of errors, right? Like, just from all over the place. And so if you actually tell me that your regression coefficient is, let's say, like, 4.3, like, that exact number, right? Like, I don't actually believe that you can give me a regression coefficient to, like, the decimal place, right? I believe you when you tell me qualitatively that you can give me a certain response and stuff. So, sort of the attitude is sort of, if you find the right data, and then essentially any method that you run on it will be okay because it'll give you about the same answer.
Are you asking if we agree with that? Or?
Yeah, sure. Like, what's your, like, that's...
In other words, the
like, is that okay? Like, sort of like...
Well, it's not okay.
We focus so much.
It's not okay.
I guess, like, the question is, we focus so much on analysis and stuff, but for a lot of people, sort of, the errors that come with analysis are, like...
But it's always... But my point is this, right? The fact that we need good designs doesn't mean we don't care about the methods. We need good designs and good methods. And people have this kind of thing like, oh, it's all about this. No, it's not all about this. We need to get it all right. So yes, good design is important because once the data, like your advisor has told you in clear terms, right? If you don't even know where it's coming from, it will only cause bias. It will only hurt you. So we need good design so that we can interpret the data in a good way. And we need good methods. Because biases occur at every place.
So is the problem education?
Is the problem education?
Yeah.
There's always a problem education. I mean, you know, seriously, that
Oh, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. I mean, it's all about education. It's about the next generation. So that's why the responsibility is with the universities in particular. That we need to educate next generations of scientific thinkers, not just followers.
And philosopher thinkers.
Yeah, and they need to be able to defend their method philosophically.
Can we rename the no hypothesis? Because that's kind of like not very sexy.
Call it a sexy hypothesis.
There you go. I think, Deborah,
yes.
You were talking about replication of studies, and it occurred to me that maybe replication means being able to replicate the biases as well as the underlying phenomena, that the better job you do of replicating whatever biases are inherent in the first study, the more likely you are to replicate them.
Exactly. And that's why I had the slide in my talk talking about that we should really be after triangulation, where we have subsequent attempts to find flaws in earlier ones. And that's why I think that if a researcher says, and I replicated, I was able to find this one group, and if you look carefully, you'll see it really isn't a replication, but they'll find some way to kind of support the earlier. Whereas the onus really is on them to show that they have seriously scrutinized how they could be wrong in the initial study and try to make it very probable that they would unearth that mistake and report on the things they could not have discriminated at all from the study they have. So I agree that that I think this this focus on the term, you know, replication, when what you really want is to increase the probability that you would have found mistakes and biases and so on.
Let me just follow up very quickly on that, because the term replication actually has lots of different meanings.
Yeah.
Most of the replication people simply mean the software you announce results can be replicated using another, you know, software, you know, even using the self-SIM software. But I also want to mention that this was a remind me of a story that quite a few years ago, I had a friend who works as a consultant for a company, and she was doing some analysis, and in the end she was asking me, let's say, you know, is this right? And I said, you know, why are you using such a simple method? This is like the simplest method. She said, well, here's what happened. This is the consequence of replication. The company had a very good intention. She said, whatever the results we produce needs to be independently replicated by three consultants. Guess what? Well, not independent. They're replicated by three consultants. Guess what happens? You find the minimum denominator that the three consultants can understand, and they can find a way to find the answer which is exactly the same. So you end up with use the simplest, the most dumb method, because it's being replicated
by the dumbest in your group.
That's right, because you know that's fine. So it's very unintended consequences, the replication.
Yes. I'm going to jump in here and suggest that while we still have an audience, to thank them.
we can thank each other. We don't have to. We don't have to.